Chapter 3. Fear and Outrage. One important reason why politics is in trouble is because so many people are afraid. They have become preoccupied with risks of bad outcomes ahead. The resulting fear constricts their minds. It pushes them away from expansive, conciliatory politics. Instead, it encourages righteous indignation, lingering resentment, impulsive reactions, and doubling down on perceived certainties. In a fight-or-flight mode, their brains have reduced ability to regulate emotions or pick up subtle cues from the environment. They grab hold of one insight and stick to it through thick and thin. The real problem here isn't simply that there are things which make us afraid. After all, humans have lived throughout history in the shadow of violence, plunder, famine, disease, aging, and death. We've had ample reason to be scared witless. Literature the world over is full of twisted tales of brother plotting against brother, lovers being unfaithful, allies betraying each other, and leaders failing to keep the promises they made to their supporters. Only the paranoid survive, warned Andy Grove, co-founder of IT giant Intel. That phrase is a modern encapsulation of ages-old wisdom. Fear has been our constant companion. Section. Violence declines, but outrage increases. Strikingly, it can be argued that we have fewer reasons to be fearful nowadays than in the past. That's the argument made in, for example, the 802 pages of Steven Pinker's 2011 book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And in his 2016 book, Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow, Yuval Noah Harari declares with gusto that humanity's epic quest against the three great scourges of plague, famine, and war is close to conclusion. Quote, "For the first time in history, more people die today from eating too much than from eating too little. More people die from old age than from infectious diseases, and more people commit suicide than are killed by soldiers, terrorists, and criminals combined." End quote. I essentially agree with the interpretations placed by Pinker and Harari on the data they review. Plague, famine, and war are on the back foot. You'll find further evidence to back up these trends in Abundance by Singularity University co-founder Peter Diamandis. But that's not the end of the story. Here are some critical complications. 1. For most of history, there were accepted social and philosophical responses to the fears that pervaded human life. For example, life is full of suffering, but people learn from their elders that they ought to accept that reality. The shocks and surprises of life were part of some divine plan or karmic retribution. For the faithful, there was a hope for a better life in some hereafter. Even for the irreligious, there was a role to be accepted in the circle of life. April showers would lead to May flowers. 2. In present times, people are much less willing to accept slings and arrows of fortune as being outside of human influence. Forget passive acquiescence. If a person dies, then someone, another person, is likely responsible. If famine sweeps a region, it's viewed not as an act of savage nature, but probably as a consequence of political failure. If someone is struck down by cancer, it could be due to an overstressed life, or a bad choice of diet, or contaminants in the environment, all of which are outcomes of human, individual, and social choices. That's all the more reason to feel angry. 3. Today's media magnifies and highlights individual cases of human misery, misfortune, and inequity as never before. The unpleasant maxim attributed to Stalin, "A single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic," speaks loudly. It's our human nature to respond viscerally to the graphic images that parade on our screens, depicting specific wretched victims of poverty, malnutrition, squalor, infection, conflict, or abuse. Our rational minds might know that, in absolute terms, fewer people than before are victims of such circumstances. But our emotional, feeling selves react differently. Once bitten, twice shy. Once outraged, we remain upset and afraid long after the trigger for that outrage has gone from sight. For that, we can thank our 24/7 rolling news channels and our omnipresent internet. 4. Most cultures have had myths of forthcoming apocalypse. The end of the world has been nigh, or so people have thought, ever since the beginning of human storytelling. Societies that ignored divine commandments or natural hierarchies could expect to be destroyed by flood, pestilence, volcanic eruption, fire from the heavens, or barbarian invaders. These fables long predate recent worries about modern-day existential risks such as nuclear Armageddon, a complete meltdown of the global financial system, or runaway global warming. But what's new is the apparent randomness and complexity of these modern-day risks. Apocalypse is no longer part of some overarching cosmic plan where humans can intercede by taking well-known steps, prayers, rituals, contrition, good deeds, etc. It will arise instead as the accidental outcome of a fiendishly complicated set of connections. That's all the more reason to be profoundly nervous. 5. The greater set of choices available nowadays paradoxically increases the level of stress that many people experience. No longer are people's careers and lifestyles primarily determined by the circumstance of their birth. This apparent abundance of choice can provoke greater anxiety, fear of missing out, and, subsequently, a visceral sense of disillusionment and betrayal if it turns out that various roles in society aren't actually feasible. 6. Perceptions of inequity matter as much as the realities. Even if the poor are better off in absolute terms than their predecessors of several generations past, they can still be roused to anger when they contemplate a widening relative gap to the ultra-rich in society. Even if the poor have access to large flat-screen TVs and hyper-connected smartphones with capabilities their grandparents could not even have imagined, they can become aggrieved by the differential access of the wealthy to superior healthcare or top-notch personalised coaching. If those born into poorer families have life expectancies 9 years less than their more fortunate neighbours, that's cause for indignation. And when the glamorous, possession-laden lifestyles of the wealthy are visible for all to see on so-called reality TV, it's no surprise that the indignation surges. 7. Indignation at inequality is particularly intense when someone who is well off is believed to have gained their fortune, not through admirable talent or heroic personal enterprise, but through trickery, deception, expropriation, or other manipulation of a rigged system. And 8. The internet has spread not only news of apparent injustices and atrocities, but also an extraordinary set of theories about the causes of these apparent injustices and atrocities. These outrages are the fault, we hear, of all kinds of shady individuals, organizations, corporations, and systems, who have been operating, we hear, with all kinds of perverse motivations. These theories mix in various degrees points of fact, points of conjecture, crude fabrications, sophisticated fabrications, suggestive analogies, solid lines of argument, dubious jumps of logic, and downright fallacies. Fictitious examples created as jokes or as satire can take on a life of their own, becoming claimed as evidence in favour of various theories, with their original genesis being overlooked. New theories are constantly emerging, combining elements of previous theories in novel ways. Most of these theories are quickly discarded, but that still leaves large numbers in active circulation, beguiling and horrifying the people who choose to believe them. Some of these theories can be called conspiracy theories, owing to their suggestions that groups of people have actively conspired to hide facts or to distort their true motivations. Some of these theories may even be essentially correct. To the extent that these theories refer to powerful villains, they provide yet more reasons for the general public to become both fearful and angry. Of course, ours is not the first age to have experienced populist panics. Previous moral certainties were upturned during, for example, the era of the Black Death. But that's hardly a reassuring precedent. What makes populist panics particularly dangerous in the present time is the amount of power that our systems of governance have placed in the democratic process. Previously, society's rulers had some flexibility to ignore surges of irrational fear that swept over the populace as a whole. That's no longer the case today. Section: Debunking, Distracting, Describing, Doubting. How should leaders and would-be leaders of society respond to the fact that large numbers of citizens feel strong mixtures of fear and outrage? These citizens may generally appear mannerly and friendly, but underneath their politeness lurks anger and frustration. They're ill at ease in the world as they see it, and they're prone to take rash action. In extreme cases, they may run off to join overseas terrorist organizations. In less extreme cases, they can cast protest votes in large numbers, giving the finger to the so-called elites. In either case, they contribute to the winds of bad-tempered frustration which whistle around discussion forums. So how should leaders respond? A first possible response is to try to debunk the theories that motivate citizens' feelings of anger and dissent. No, the EU has not dictated rules about the shapes of bananas. No, 9/11 was not an inside job. No, the Quran does not require all pious Muslims to pick up lethal armaments in a fight against the unbelievers. No, the scientists who produce reports about global warming are not all part of a conspiracy to hide evidence of sunspot activity from the public. No, immigrants don't lower the economic well-being. No, poverty isn't on the up and up, it's actually declining worldwide. So relax, the world's not as wicked as you've been told. Note, however, that this kind of debunking, by itself, makes little headway on people immersed in countercultural thinking. Each debating point made in the previous paragraph can quickly be met with a counterpoint. For example, the EU may not have dictated the shapes of bananas, but there are plenty other poor EU policies that could be highlighted. 9/11 may not have been an inside job, but Osama bin Laden was for a long time a darling of some parts of the Western establishment. And so the discussions run and run and run. After all, the arguments offered in the course of these discussions are often rational confabulations for feelings that are deeply lodged in someone's subconscious mind. These arguments aren't the cause of the feelings, but are instead an outgrowth of someone's personal dissatisfaction and self-identity. Refuting the argument generally won't cause any positive change of heart. If anything, it might provoke greater bitterness. A second kind of response, therefore, is to try to distract citizens away from any preoccupation with radical oppositional politics. Okay, there are bad things happening in the world, but there are plenty of ways for citizens to have a good life. Don't rock the boat. Enjoy unprecedented amounts of low-cost multicultural food, exhilarating streaming music, comic online videos, wonderfully plotted box set dramas, engaging computer games, free online education, discount package holidays, easy internet hookups with new intimate partners, and numerous career opportunities for those willing to work hard and work smart. This is the modern-day equivalent of the Soma drugs, provided to citizens in Aldous Huxley's dystopian novel Brave New World. Indeed, near-future politicians may have at their disposal new mood drugs that leave everyone happier and more blissful all the time. The distraction would be complete. However, we're not there yet, and present-day distractions are limited in their effectiveness. A third response, accordingly, is to describe step-by-step improvement projects that are intended to alleviate the actual grounds for fear and outrage. This is the approach taken, for example, by Theresa May in the speech she delivered outside No. 10 Downing Street just after being appointed the UK's Prime Minister. Whatever you may think about her subsequent actions and inactions, it's a speech full of fine sentiment. It's worth quoting at some length, especially for its seemingly candid recognition of many of the problems being experienced by citizenry. Quote, "We believe in a union not just between the nations of the United Kingdom, but between all our citizens, every one of us, whoever we are and wherever we're from. That means fighting against the burning injustice that, if you're born poor, you will die on average 9 years earlier than others. If you're black, you're treated more harshly by the criminal justice system than if you're white. If you're a white, working-class boy, you're less likely than anybody else in Britain to go to university. If you're at a state school, you're less likely to reach the top professions than if you're educated privately. If you're a woman, you will earn less than a man. If you suffer from mental health problems, there's not enough help to hand. If you're young, you'll find it harder than ever before to own your own home." End quote. Prime Minister May then proceeded to address the people who just about manage to cope with the struggles of life. Quote, "The mission to make Britain a country that works for everyone means more than fighting these injustices. If you're from an ordinary working class family, life is much harder than many people in Westminster realise. You have a job, but you don't always have job security. You have your own home, but you worry about paying a mortgage. You can just about manage, but you worry about the cost of living and getting your kids into a good school. If you're one of those families, if you're just managing, I want to address you directly. I know you're working around the clock. I know you're doing your best, and I know that sometimes life can be a struggle. The government I lead will be driven not by the interests of the privileged few, but by yours. We will make Britain a country that works not for a privileged few, but for every one of us. That will be the mission of the government I lead, and together we will build a better Britain." End quote. These improvement projects lie within the broad mainstream of existing politics. In the United States, presidential candidate Hillary Clinton anticipated taking a broadly similar approach, reform from within. But many people doubt whether such politics-as-usual projects will succeed. They worry as follows. Are the politicians who make such statements being genuine, or are they just paying lip service to notions which they will not pursue? Will these politicians be constrained by powerful vested interests, such as media barons, multinational corporations, and various industrial complexes? Are today's political institutions, with their traditions stretching hundreds of years into the past, sufficiently suited to the fast-changing needs of contemporary issues? Even if improvements are made, might other things get worse even faster than the improvements are being applied? And are mainstream political initiatives really capable of getting to the roots of the problems facing society? I share these doubts. As I see things, humanity is facing a number of fundamental risks. Keeping calm and carrying on may have been good advice in the past, but it's no longer viable. The onrushing tsunami of technological and social disruption cannot be tamed by diplomatic hand-waving, adjusting tax rates, or tweaking the budget for welfare provision. Many others evidently feel the same way as well, though we might articulate our understanding of these risks in very different ways. That widespread deep disquiet provides fertile ground for conspiracy theories and other explanations of the status quo. Even if some of these theories are debunked, people hunger for more, so new theories arise to fill the void. Even if the distracting marvels of fine living appear in adverts all around us, we remain dissatisfied, yearning for a sense of justice and purpose that mere material luxury cannot provide. Even if mainstream politicians try to embrace us into their pragmatic projects for incremental change, we feel alienated, and we find solace instead in dissident groups. Even in the face of evidence of progress in dealing with poverty and disease, we think to ourselves, it's too slow and too little and probably too late. Section. Reasons to be outraged. At the close of 2016, many articles appeared declaring that year to have been the best ever. Kevin D. Williamson urged readers in National Review to stop complaining about 2016, you sissies. Quote, 2016 was the best year in human history, and 2017 almost certainly will be better. In the past 30 years, the worldwide rate of extreme poverty has been halved. In the past 10 years, new diagnoses of HIV in the United States were reduced by 20%, and the number of Americans who die from AIDS is today about 14% of what it was at its high point in the 1990s. Howard Hughes was one of the richest men in the world, but he never drove a car as good as yours. Most of your grandparents never set foot in a house as nice as an ordinary new house in 2016. And the children who are born in 2017 will one day look back on us as poor. End quote. Marshalling a suite of statistics, contrarian environmental analyst Bjorn Lomberg addressed the same theme. Quote, reading the opinion pages, there is a sense that the world is facing a malaise that exceeds any individual events, and that people are becoming increasingly and dangerously divided. But if we take a step back, it is clear that there are many reasons to be optimistic. Indeed, in many ways, we are alive at the best time in history. Consider rising inequality, one of the year's most frequently addressed topics. To be sure, over the last two centuries or so, the gap between the highest and lowest incomes has grown. But that is because pretty much everyone was equally dirt poor in 1820. More than 90% of humanity lived in absolute poverty. Then the Industrial Revolution arrived, bringing rapid income growth wherever it spread, with China since 1978 and India since 1990 recording particularly high rates. As a result, last year, less than 10% of the world's population was living in absolute poverty. Furthermore, developing economies are now contributing to a burgeoning global middle class, whose numbers have more than doubled from around 1 billion people in 1985 to 2.3 billion in 2015. This tremendous reduction in poverty has sustained a decline in global income inequality over the past three decades. Inequality has fallen by other measures as well. Since 1992, the number of hungry people worldwide has plummeted by more than 200 million, even as the human population grew by nearly 2 billion. The percentage of people starving has nearly halved, from 19% to 11%. In 1870, more than three quarters of the world was illiterate, and access to education was even more unequal than income. Today, more than four out of five people can read, and young people have unprecedented access to schooling. The illiterate come mostly from older generations. The story is similar in health. In 1990, almost 13 million children died before the age of five each year. Thanks to vaccines, better nutrition, and healthcare, that number has fallen below 6 million. More broadly, lifespan inequality is lower today because medical breakthroughs that were available only to the elite a century ago are now more broadly accessible. In short, the world is not going to hell in a handbasket. End quote. Lomberg's article ends with a rallying cry. Quote, most of the important indicators show that life is better today than it was in the past. We should celebrate the progress we have made against disease, famine, and poverty. And we should continue to advance that progress by focusing on the smart development investments needed to resolve the real problems we face. End quote. I echo that rallying cry. But the statistics quoted in such articles paint only a part of the overall picture. A fool of you needs to recognise signs of setback as well as signs of progress, risks as well as opportunities. It's as expressed by futurist Ramesh Nam in his excellent book, The Infinite Resource, The Power of Ideas on a Finite Planet. Quote, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." The opening line of Charles Dickens's 1859 masterpiece, A Tale of Two Cities, applies equally well to our present era. We live in unprecedented wealth and comfort, with capabilities undreamt of in previous ages. We live in a world facing unprecedented global risks, risks to our continued prosperity, to our survival, and to the health of our planet itself. We might think of our current situation as a tale of two earths. End quote. The most systematic collation of statistics about trends impacting future social well-being is probably the State of the Future analysis conducted every year since 1997 by the Millennium Project. The State of the Future Index comprises 28 separate variables. The authors of the State of the Future V19.1 report, published in 2017, noted the following in their executive summary. Quote, "The State of the Future is a comprehensive overview of the present situation and prospects for humanity, integrating forecasts, trends, and judgments of thought leaders and scholars from around the world, sharing important future possibilities to improve strategies today." The 2017 State of the Futures Index shows that we are winning more than we are losing, so we have no right to be pessimistic. However, where we are losing is very serious, so we cannot fall asleep either. End quote. The authors proceed to reject both pessimism and naive optimism. Quote, "After updating global developments and trends within the 15 global challenges for over 20 years, it is clear that humanity has the means to avoid potential disasters described in this report and to build a great future. Pessimism is an intellectually cowardly position that need not prove anything and can stunt the growth of innovative, idealistic minds. Yet idealism, untested by pessimism, or unaware of the depth and magnitude of global problems, fosters naivety that can waste our time, and time is not on our side. We need hard-headed, pragmatic idealists willing to understand the depths of human depravity and heights of human wisdom. We need serious, coherent, and integrated understandings of mega problems and mega opportunities to identify and implement strategies on the scale necessary to address global challenges. Doing everything right to address climate change or counter organized crime in one country will not make enough of a difference if others do not act as well. The challenges we face are transnational in scope and trans-institutional in solution. We need coordinated transnational implementation. Government and corporate future strategy units are proliferating, but they have yet to sufficiently influence decisions on the scale and speed necessary to address the complex, integrated, and global nature of accelerating change. Intergovernmental organizations and public-private collaborations are also increasing, but they too have to become far more effective." End quote. Underpinning these conclusions is the fact that, whilst there is positive progress in 18 of the 28 variables tracked in the State of the Future Index, the other 10 areas feature as where we are losing or there is no progress. Areas of concern include growing unemployment, increasing fossil fuel and cement production emissions, declining freshwater resources, continuing deforestation, reduced biocapacity, a surge in terrorist incidents, growing income inequality, the share taken by the top 10%, and continued public sector corruption. Even in areas where the statistical trends are in a positive direction, there is cause for concern. Why isn't progress faster? Even if the number of people living in abject poverty has declined, there are still huge numbers living in comparative misery and squalor, at risk from diseases that could easily be eradicated if the world's resources were applied in different ways. The arms trade still thrives on the distribution of devastating weaponry to overseas buyers with poor human rights records and with scant processes to prevent the onward flow of these weapons to radical insurgent forces. The perceived complacency of many mainstream politicians and business leaders in the face of these challenges generates contempt, where they shrug their shoulders, saying, "We're doing what we can," and then rush off to the next lusciously catered international gathering. This provides added impetus for the conspiracy theorists. They think to themselves, these elites could be doing so much more. Evidently, they don't really care. Section: The Fog of Connections. If a State of the Future Index had been calculated in, say, 1912, it would likely have shown the same mix of positive trends and negative trends as the one from 2017. Remarkable economic progress was taking place in the wake of electrification, the popularization of the motor car, the manufacturing of synthetic chemicals, and assembly line systems of mass production. Countries had put in place early welfare systems with basic pension plans. Public sector efforts in sanitation and vaccination were having noticeable effects on health. Growing trade interdependence between nations led many people to conclude that major wars could no longer be contemplated. For example, in his 1910 book, The Great Illusion, Norman Angell, a British journalist who was subsequently awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, argued that war between the great powers had become an economic impossibility because of the delicate interdependence of international finance. Writing for Reuters 100 years later, Anatole Kaletsky provides additional historical perspective. Quote, a 1910 best-selling book, The Great Illusion, used economic arguments to demonstrate that territorial conquest had become unprofitable and therefore global capitalism had removed the risk of major wars. This view became so well established that, less than a year before the Great War broke out, The Economist reassured its readers with an editorial entitled, "War Becomes Impossible in a Civilized World." The powerful bonds of commercial interest between ourselves and Germany, The Economist insisted, have been immensely strengthened in recent years, removing Germany from the list of our possible foes. End quote. As late as spring 1914, Henry Noel Brailsford, a British member of the International Commission reporting on the Balkans Wars, concurred, quote, in Europe, the epoch of conquest is over. It is as certain as anything in politics that the frontiers of our national states are finally drawn. My own belief is that there will be no more war among the six powers. End quote. Similar overconfident predictions of ongoing stability, made by apparent experts, were heard ahead of other international crises, such as the financial crashes of 1929 and 2008. Here's an assurance made in a Wall Street investor conference call in August 2007 by Joe Cassano, AIG Chief Financial Officer. Quote, it is hard for us, and without being flippant, to even see a scenario within any kind of realm of reason that would see us losing $1 in any of those credit default swaps transactions. End quote. In view of subsequent enormous losses by AIG, Cassano's forecast was remarkably ill-judged. What causes such forecasts to fail is connections that no one fully understands and innovations that no one fully understands, unfounded overconfidence, underestimates of the weaknesses in existing human psychology and the weaknesses in existing social institutions, systems that are pumped up and take on a life of their own via runaway positive feedback cycles, and sets of ideas that have been distorted from hypothesis through ideology to faith and dogma. It would be a brave and foolhardy forecaster who would maintain that the hugely complex, massively interdependent systems of the present day have no shocks and surprises left to deliver to us. The kind of systemic breakdown that happened in 1914 could well happen again, all too soon. But this time, the effect would likely be even more calamitous. Section: Two-Edged Crises. In the run-up to the 2020s, the world contains more opportunities than ever before, but also more risks than ever before. Both sets of possibilities need to be kept clearly in mind. To the extent that our political and other leaders lose sight of these major opportunities or major risks, that is a legitimate cause for outrage. In my days at university, in the 1970s and 1980s, lots of people were concerned with the risk of accidental nuclear war. Heated arguments took place over the relative merits of unilateral versus multilateral disarmament. Fortunately, the intervening decades have passed without these horrific arsenals of death being unleashed. But that's no reason for congratulation. As a 31-slide presentation by the Future of Life Institute documents, there have been dozens of near-miss situations where humanity came perilously close to the worst kind of accident. If military leaders had strictly followed their agreed defense protocols, massive retaliatory strikes would have been launched, and you and I probably wouldn't be here today. Thankfully, good human judgment prevailed in all these tense near-miss situations. However, factors that increase the risks of nuclear war remain in place. An increasing number of countries have access to the requisite deadly technology, including the near-inscrutable hermit kingdom of North Korea. Leaders whose grasp on power depends on populist grandstanding may become carried away by their own dizzying rhetoric and/or depressed state of mind. Due to confusion arising from rapidly changing local circumstances, some nuclear weapons may slip out of the supervision of national governments into the control of radical groups who feel little moral restraint over using massive force. And it's not only the weapons themselves which are vulnerable to being stolen by dissident elements. The control systems that supervise these weapons are subject to being attacked as part of cyber warfare, with unpredictable consequences. Nuclear annihilation, with its effects compounded by a likely subsequent nuclear winter ice age, is just one of the major threats to present-day civilization. Biological weapons involving specially targeted viruses could prove just as devastating. And as I'll explore in more depth in the chapters ahead, other sorts of risks deserve urgent attention too. 1. Increasing social angst and mass protest in response to structural unemployment, lower wages, greater salary differentials, and difficulty in finding meaningful employment, with these changes arising in turn from factors such as workplace automation and dogmatic austerity spending cuts. Torrents of mass disaffection could dramatically eclipse the activities of the Tea Party and Occupy movements in terms of turning society upside down. 2. Intense corporate and governmental surveillance of everything that we do via numerous sensors, cameras, and other eavesdropping devices, with these systems being vulnerable to misuse and hijacking for all kinds of undesirable purposes. Expect countermeasures from self-declared resistance fighters and waves of change throughout society in the wake of a subsequent multi-pronged arms race. 3. Crisis in healthcare funding, as people beset by chronic diseases demand fuller access to expensive treatments. Extended lifespans run the risk of being accompanied by an epidemic of dementia and a failure of budgets set aside for pensions. The resulting care costs may cripple national expenditure. 4. As more people around the world adopt features of the affluent lifestyles of Americans and Europeans, crises loom due to imminent shortages of fresh water, arable land, and rare elements. These crises could be worsened by increasingly adverse weather due to runaway global warming and by other tipping points in the biological systems in our environment. 5. The major banking failure of 2007-09 is unlikely to be the last. Financial innovations can have the advantage of making new forms of funding available to projects in need of investment, but they often also have the drawback of complicating the network of cause-effect monetary relationships beyond the comprehension and management of regulators. Add in software algorithms following rules that are beyond human understanding, and the stage is set for a financial meltdown that exceeds what has gone before. 6. It's not just banks and investment algorithms that can have adverse effects that are difficult to foresee. Ever more powerful corporations likewise risk pushing society in unfavorable directions. Industrial policies which make sense for a given period of time, such as subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, can become stuck in a state of inertia, with a narrow pursuit of shareholder returns resulting in a grievous loss of planetary capital. The appropriate balance between government intervention in markets and laissez-faire libertarianism has proved hard to agree. If the biggest companies of all, such as Google and Apple, fall foul of some sudden major crisis, it may prove to be too late for the public as a whole to reassert sensible oversight. Too big to fail could take on a dreadful new meaning. 7. Just as markets can fail, so also can governments. Most countries evolved a set of checks and balances with distributed power to reduce the damage that could result if an autocrat was somehow elevated into a position of political leadership. However, recent trends have been towards national heads of government with increasing amounts of personal power. Some political leaders may acquire so much wealth that they become the richest people in the world. As power tends to corrupt, absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. That's far from being in the national interest. 8. The intergovernmental bodies set up after the Second World War, the so-called Bretton Woods institutions, such as the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the United Nations, seem increasingly ill-suited to the complexities of 21st century life. Better methods of international cooperation are sorely needed, lest conflicts between diverse national interests spiral out of control. And 9. Enhancements to human bodies and brains are at hand, but are highly controversial. Gene modifications and neural implants, to mention just two possibilities, might give some short-term benefits to the groups or nations that approve them, even before their longer-term consequences have been understood. It could be like a repeat of the indiscriminate use of pesticides such as DDT, or morning sickness drugs such as thalidomide, each of which was subsequently deeply regretted. Biological modifications to human nature, even if motivated by desires for greater manifestation of human kindness and empathy, could have enormous adverse, unpredictable side effects. The next 9 chapters of this book address the above 9 points in turn, as part of a set of wider discussions about the important opportunities that coexist with these existential risks. I will argue that failures of existing political leaders to comprehensively address these risks diminish their authority, making it more likely that maverick outsiders will seize power, regardless of the actual suitability of these outsiders for high office. Although there are major risks ahead, this should not paralyze our thinking or lead us to counterproductive attempts to stifle technological progress. And these forthcoming risks, seen in their larger context, can provide the right motivation for worldwide Apollo-scale endeavours to accelerate the beneficial development of technology, human nature, and the structure of society. In short, we can transform our legitimate fear and outrage regarding present and future developments from being a negative force that is sending politics on a downward spiral into a positive force to integrate and harness the best skills and insights from around the planet. But for that to happen, we need to look squarely and soberly at the two-edged crises emerging in our midst. We need to identify the underlying drivers of change and actively steer them in a radical techno-progressive direction. Let's start that process by looking more closely at one fear that might be more fundamental than all those I listed above. It's fear of science. Section: Science and Spirit. Whilst we humans have plenty of reasons to admire science, we are increasingly led to fear it as well. Science deserves hearty applause for facilitating remarkable technological progress throughout recent history, with its comprehensive theoretical models of forces, materials, reactions, orbits, compounds, organisms, genetics, ecosystems, evolutionary pathways, and much more. Science has done wonders to multiply our agricultural capacity, reduce childhood disease, enable speedy travel around the world, and create vast electronic systems for education and entertainment. But despite these accomplishments, science is widely perceived to be a dehumanizing force. To be clear, it's rare for someone to say they are flat out opposed to science. It's just that they fear science risks overreach. They fear that society is putting too much faith in science. At least some scientists are getting too self-assured. As science grows more dominant, there may appear to be less room for some of the vital aspects of human experience. To the extent that scientists assert there's no such thing as a human soul, critics say they know in their own soul that these scientists are mistaken. To the extent that scientists deny the Earth was mindfully designed and assert instead that it emerged mindlessly from interstellar chaos, critics say these views engender chaos in the minds of upstanding men and women of religious faith. Hence the fear. It's true that scientists have often overreached themselves. Consider Antoine Lavoisier, often heralded as the father of modern chemistry, who enjoyed a reputation as a debunker of superstitious beliefs such as water dowsing and remote viewing. Born in 1743, Lavoisier emerged as a leading critic of the populist idea that rocks could fall out of the heavens onto the earth. Meteorites, as we would now call them, were too closely tied up in Lavoisier's mind with pre-scientific fantasies of cloud-dwelling deities hurling thunderbolts at tiresome humans. When peasants in far-off fields reported that a glowing rock had dropped out of the sky at their feet, why, they had probably been drinking. Their testimony was unreliable. There was no room in Lavoisier's tidy scientific cosmology for rocks to exist in space. He declared at a meeting of the Académie Française des Sciences that stones cannot fall from the sky because there are no stones in the sky. Luminary predecessors such as Aristotle and Newton had held similar views. Then, in 1768, there were sufficient reputable spectators to a rock falling out of the sky at Lucé, France, that a team involving Lavoisier took part in what was the world's first chemical analysis of such a rock. The chemists found a preponderance of iron pyrites and concluded that it was simply a piece of normal sandstone that had been struck and dislodged by lightning. Under the influence of such views, museums at Dresden, Vienna, Copenhagen, Bern, and Verona removed from their displays and discarded meteorites which had fallen in the 16th and 17th century, an act described by the writer Ernst Chladni as Enlightenment vandalism. Scientists themselves have reported their bitter regret at being carried away with particular projects. As they saw things afterwards, they had let their scientific enthusiasm override their better judgment. Many who were involved in the 1940s Manhattan Project to develop the first atomic bomb were subsequently horrified at the extent of human suffering caused not only by the sheer blast of the weapons at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also by the unexpectedly high number of radiation victims. Scientists are particularly unpopular with the administration of President Trump. Trump's cabinet regards with suspicion the views of the scientific establishment on matters such as climate change, environmental protection, and, in some cases, the safety of vaccinations. In July 2017, the Union of Concerned Scientists issued a report highlighting ways in which the Trump administration was sidelining science. Quote, since President Trump took office in January 2017, his administration, aided and abetted by Congress, has waged a war on science, undermining the role of science in public policy, giving industry undue influence on decision-making processes, creating a hostile environment for federal scientists, and reducing public access to scientific information. This pattern of anti-science actions threatens the health and safety of the American people, with the greatest impacts likely to fall on the nation's most vulnerable populations. The science community and the general public have responded to this threat with vigorous resistance, and we must continue to stand up for science if we are to prevent the worst potential consequences of the Trump administration's actions. End quote. The report provides a historical perspective before enumerating particular areas of concern. Quote, political interference in government science is not new. Previous administrations and their allies have engaged in many of the same kinds of attack the report identifies. But under the Trump administration, these threats to the federal scientific enterprise have escalated markedly. The report documents a long list of tactics being used by the Trump administration and Congress to diminish the role of science in our democracy. Sidelining independent science advice. The Trump administration has weakened federal advisory committees that provide scientific advice to the government. Appointing conflicted individuals to scientific leadership positions. President Trump has appointed to the highest positions in government individuals with little science background and with strong ties to the industries they are charged with regulating. Leaving key science positions vacant. President Trump has taken an unusually long time to fill many high-level science positions, signaling the low priority his administration places on science. And revoking science-based safeguards. Aided and abetted by Congress, President Trump has allowed politics to supersede science by signing an unprecedented 13 congressional resolutions rolling back science-based protections, including safe drinking water standards and safeguards to prevent worker exposure to harmful chemicals. End quote. This evident disdain for science reflects the wider unease of many voters for the direction in which scientists appear to be headed, towards a world in which scientists increasingly tell people how to behave, restricting their freedom, whilst accumulating more funding and prestige for themselves. It's a world of perceived overreach, in which the magic of human individuality is curtailed. Science may be increasing the efficiency of human society, but at the cost, it is feared, of diminishing human spirit. Even scientists are concerned about the status of science. They're concerned not just about attacks on it from outsiders, but at structural problems with the way science is being carried out. In 2016, Fox researchers Julia Belous, Brad Plummer, and Brian Resnick surveyed scientists from around the world at numerous levels of seniority about the status of scientific research. Here's how they described their research. Quote, in the past several years, many scientists have become afflicted with a serious case of doubt. Doubt in the very institution of science. As reporters covering medicine, psychology, climate change, and other areas of research, we wanted to understand this epidemic of doubt. So we sent scientists a survey asking this simple question: if you could change one thing about how science works today, what would it be, and why? We heard back from 270 scientists all over the world, including graduate students, senior professors, laboratory heads, and Fields medalists. They told us that, in a variety of ways, their careers are being hijacked by perverse incentives. The result is bad science. The scientific process, in its ideal form, is elegant. Ask a question, set up an objective test, and get an answer. Repeat. Science is rarely practiced to that ideal, but Copernicus believed in that ideal. So did the rocket scientists behind the moon landing. But nowadays, our respondents told us, the process is riddled with conflict. Scientists say they're forced to prioritise self-preservation over pursuing the best questions and uncovering meaningful truths. End quote. Based on the survey responses, the Vox researchers produced a daunting list of the biggest challenges facing science. Quote, 1. Academia has a huge money problem. 2. Too many studies are poorly designed. 3. Replicating results is crucial and rare. 4. Peer review is broken. 5. Too much science is locked behind paywalls. 6. Science is poorly communicated. And 7. Life as a young academic is incredibly stressful. End quote. If science can no longer be trusted, if scientists themselves are doubtful about the value of their work, where should we turn for clarity? Of course, various people have a vested interest in there being doubt and fear surrounding the findings of science. Various business leaders prefer to continue to make short-term profits by sticking with industrial practices that scientists think will cause problems in the longer term and in the wider environment. Various leaders of religious communities dislike the way that scientific findings challenge the doctrines of their faith. And various government departments would prefer a larger share of public funding to come in their direction, with less being allocated to science-driven regulatory policy development. The right response here is not less science, but better science. Although strong evidence should be required before major changes are made to policy recommendation, good science is about maintaining an open mind to possible new phenomena and new explanations. And good science seeks to involve the public as a whole in understanding the scientific issues, explaining the evidence both for and against different hypotheses, and highlighting the areas where significant doubt remains. Thankfully, the Vox survey covered not just the set of the largest problems facing science, but also a comprehensive set of concrete recommendations to address these problems. Quote, fixes for science's funding woes, fixes for poor study design, fixes for under-replication, fixes for peer review, fixes for closed science, fixes for better science communication, and fixes to keep young scientists in science. End quote. None of these fixes are straightforward, but the encouraging news is that an increasing number of science professionals are aware of these issues and are working to improve the discipline. As fixes are implemented, the reputation of science will be set to rise again. That still leaves the question of whether science should be seen as somehow opposed to the well-being of the human spirit. Transhumanists are emphatically opposed to any such conclusion. They share the sentiment expressed by biologist Richard Dawkins in his 1998 book, Unweaving the Rainbow. Quote, the feeling of awed wonder that science can give us is one of the highest experiences of which the human psyche is capable. It is a deep aesthetic passion to rank with the finest that music and poetry can deliver. It is truly one of the things that make life worth living. End quote. As the book's publisher explains, The title of the book refers to a famous retort by the poet John Keats concerning Newton's celebrated decomposition of white light into the colours of the rainbow. Was the beauty of the rainbow diminished by Newton's scientific experiment? Quote, did Newton unweave the rainbow by reducing it to its prismatic colours, as Keats contended? Did he, in other words, diminish beauty? Far from it, says acclaimed scientist Richard Dawkins. Newton's unweaving is the key to much of modern astronomy and to the breathtaking poetry of modern cosmology. Mysteries don't lose their poetry because they are solved. The solution is often more beautiful than the puzzle, uncovering deeper mysteries. End quote. Indeed, science can be an excellent ally to humanity. As we transcend the earlier period of our evolutionary history, a period in which blind faith often played a necessary role, into a period where constructive scepticism is the key to the richest of experiences. On this subject, I'll turn one more time to Dawkins and Unweaving the Rainbow. Quote, not to grow up properly is to retain our caterpillar quality from childhood, where it is a virtue, into adulthood, where it becomes a vice. In childhood, our credulity serves us well. It helps us to pack, with extraordinary rapidity, our skulls full of the wisdom of our parents and our ancestors. But if we don't grow out of it in the fullness of time, our caterpillar nature makes us a sitting target for astrologers, mediums, gurus, evangelists, and quacks. The genius of the human child, mentor caterpillar extraordinary, is for soaking up information and ideas, not for criticizing them. If critical faculties later grow, it will be in spite of, not because of, the inclinations of childhood. The blotting paper of the child's brain is the unpromising seedbed, the base upon which later the sceptical attitude, like a struggling mustard plant, may possibly grow. We need to replace the automatic credulity of childhood with the constructive scepticism of adult science. End quote. Should we be content to leave citizens as a sitting target for astrologers, mediums, gurus, evangelists, and quacks? Nowadays, any such list of the exploiters of scientific illiteracy would add in populist demagogues. Or should we instead battle to prepare ourselves to take full collective advantage of the best that science can offer? That's definitely a battle worth fighting. The constructive scepticism of adult science will play a vital role in addressing the major risks highlighted in each of the 9 chapters that follow. Section. Evidence ahead. To help orient you on your way through the material ahead, look out for evidence that I will be offering from time to time in support of what I have labelled the 4 techno-progressive pillars. That is, look out for evidence of the possibilities for extending and improving the technocratic application of empirical analysis and the constructive scepticism of adult science, the merit of adopting inclusive, democratic approaches to the risks and opportunities ahead, and the dangers in relying on hands-off libertarian approaches or elitist top-down prescriptions, the relevance of the paradigm-busting ideas of transhumanism, setting out a motivational higher vision of what we can all achieve, and the urgency of accelerating serious analysis of the scenarios and options available to us. Now is no time for complacency. Let's move on to the looming crisis of work and purpose.